It's Jeff Levering for Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Check out that effortless horizontal window slide and the best lifetime warranties in the industry. Order by April 30th and get 0% for 48 months at PellaWI.com.
Certain restrictions apply.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank, get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Strange sort of stuff. Sarah Godlewski, who was the, formerly she was the state treasurer, the Democrat, and then she ran for U.S. Senate in 2022, and she was one of the ones that, bailed right before the primary election in order to throw her support to, Mandela Barnes. What really happened is the Democrats got together before the primary election and said, hey, we need to unite. We don't want to have a contested primary. Mandela Barnes is our choice to run against Ron Johnson. So everybody get out. And so everybody pretty much did. Galuski, who'd been running for over a year, and Alex Lazary, who'd been running for over a year, everybody just suddenly dropped their campaigns. Mandela Barnes won essentially by acclamation and went on to lose to Ron Johnson. How did that whole strategy work out? But Godlewski, who was kind of floating around then on the perimeter of politics, after Doug La Follette, who had been Secretary of State for nearly 50 years, and the Secretary of State does very, very little, he ran for re-election and then promptly quit, you know, which was this, and then she replaced him. And the way the law in Wisconsin works, the way the Constitution works, is that, you know, she is allowed to fill his term. And I don't think there's any question in reality what happened is La Follette ran. He won a very, very close race. But I believe that he calculated that, well, if there's a better chance of him winning than maybe somebody else. So he ran and then immediately sort of quit. So now Godlewski comes in and she's the Secretary of State, which is sort of like, I don't know, being the king of some small African nation. The Secretary of State really doesn't do very much at all. And Godlewski is apparently already realizing that, I don't know, if I was going to do this as a stepping stone to a bigger office, maybe this hasn't worked out really well. So what she's apparently been doing is she's been, I don't know, signing up to appear on national stages to talk about elections. You know, she's saying that she wants to use her new office, which is Secretary of State, to help improve transparency and accountability in elections. That's fine, except that the job of Secretary of State has nothing to do with the transparency and accountability in elections. She was scheduled this week to be a featured speaker along with the Georgia Secretary of State at a conference in Chicago on protecting voters, election integrity and confidence, a tale from two battleground states. That's what it was called. The difference is the Georgia Secretary of State, that is his responsibility, is kind of the election integrity stuff. And what's creating issues is that the people that really are responsible for running elections and things, like the Wisconsin Election Commission, they're out there saying, wait, you know, what's going on here? All you're doing is creating confusion because you're not an election official. So, you know, why are you out there essentially pretending to be an election official? My advice would be, you know, kind of stay in your lane and do what the job of the Secretary of State is supposed to do. And candidly, I mean, Tony Evers should probably tell her that. The other news that came out over the last 12 hours or so is the Republicans have announced, the Republican Assembly at least, have announced that they have cut a deal with bipartisan support. There's going to be Democrats that support this as well, to essentially create some form of revenue sharing with communities across the state. Now, for those of you who haven't been following this, what happens is the state collects sales tax from all over the country, from all over the state. And the argument has been the state does not send as much, they collect more from places like Milwaukee, and they don't send enough back to allow Milwaukee to do its job. And that is why, on a regular basis, what happens is whenever there's a problem in, say, Milwaukee, you have the local officials that come out and say, well, the problem is we don't get enough money back from the state. We talked about this yesterday. All these pothole problems, well, we don't get enough money back from the state. That's why we can't fix the potholes. And it kind of goes on and on and on and on. And that's been the excuse that's been used for the longest time. So, and by the way, there's two things to say about this. There is some validity in that. I mean, and I've been one that's argued for the longest time that I think municipalities like Milwaukee, the city of, and Milwaukee County, they should be able, if they want to increase their sales tax and they want to put a referendum out to discuss that and voters are willing to support it, I think that that should be something that they should be allowed to do. And so I've been arguing that for the longest time. So anyhow, what happens is there is this proposal that's launched yesterday, which says, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to change our shared revenue formula. And essentially it's, you know, 10 cents out of every 50 cents that we collect. There's a 5% sales tax that the state pays, and they're going to send 20% back to different municipalities. All right. So this will give the communities more money. And it's what Milwaukee's been asking for the longest time. And quite candidly, I'm glad to see him do it because I'm just tired of hearing local officials plead poverty every time something happens. Well, we know there's a problem, but we just don't have enough money. But interestingly, there are, and the way Wisconsin Right Now, which is one of the websites that's been covering this, the way they phrase it is there are all sorts of quote-unquote Easter eggs that are put in this legislation. Because, see, here's the truth. One of the reasons that people in Madison have been reluctant to send large quantities of taxpayer money back to, like, a community like Milwaukee is there is a concern, particularly outstate, that the money comes back and it's spent in a frivolous fashion. And we can go through all the different ways that Milwaukee spends money in a way that would make drunken sailors embarrassed. But built into this legislation, which is going to go to the state Senate, are all sorts of Easter eggs. So this money is going to come back to Milwaukee County and the city and other communities across the country, out the state as well. But there's going to be conditions on it. First of all, Milwaukee can't defund the police department. The plan requires the number of sworn officers to stay at 1,630, which is what it is now, and grow to 1,725 over time. So that means city officials are agreeing not to cut the number of sworn officers. The Milwaukee streetcar cannot expand with public money. If the streetcar is going to expand, it would have to be with private grants, and that's just not going to happen. The Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission will have a cop and firefighter on it. No business closures for more than 14 days if another pandemic hits without a vote. So health officials couldn't simply come in and say, we're going to close up Milwaukee County, for example, for months and months. Local government would have to vote every 14 days if there are closures. And it goes on and on. But there's a number of different, again, what they call Easter eggs, which are ways to control. Yes, we'll give you the money, but at the same time, we're going to try to do things to make sure that you spend it in a responsible fashion, like we're not going to fund future expansion of the trolley, and we're not going to let you come in and cut police officer jobs. Those elements, I think, are key, candidly, to why conservatives should be in favor of something like this. And, of course, apparently because both the new mayor and the county executive are showing up at this press conference in support of it, they apparently have come around and they are agreeing to that as well. So that's the untold story about the what's going on with the funding. And if you want to read more about that, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620. But I've got a link to the story on Wisconsin Right Now, which talks about some of these different conditions that are put on these grants. Yes, we'll let you impose a sales tax if voters go along with it. Yes, we'll give you more in state revenue, but we're going to put some controls on how you spend it. And in general, as I say in my tweet, look, the devil is in the details, but these details aren't too devilish. As a matter of fact, they're good public policy. All right, when we come back, reckless driving. Stick around. So very glad to have you with us. And by the way, we've been doing this for the last week or so. We are live streaming. You can listen to us live. But if you're one of those people that want to see what we all look like and you want to watch the radio program, we are streaming. We're on the YouTube channel. You can go to WTMJ.com, and instead of clicking on the Listen Live button, you can click the Watch Live button, and you can see what we all look like here at the studio. The one thing is, I'm still getting used to this, is that the lights are really, really bright. And in our previous studio on Capitol Drive, the lights were really, really dim. Well, now the lights are really, really bright, and they're cranked up full blast because apparently it makes it better for the cameras. But I always describe this to people. I mean, if I knew how to take out tonsils, I have enough light now to take out tonsils. There's no question about it. But you can check it out again. And I know a number of you do because I get comments on, oh, you're wearing something blue today or whatever. So, Jeff, you need a haircut. Got a haircut this morning. So all that stuff is going on. Matter of fact, I told the lady that cuts my hair, I said, hey, we have to be really careful now because we're streaming and people can watch us and it's out there forever, for goodness sake. So she did a particularly good job this morning. All right. We talk regularly on this program about reckless driving. And I think we can all agree with a couple things. First of all, reckless driving is just absolutely out of control and has been out of control in this community for a long time. Secondly, one of the reasons that reckless driving is out of control is that there is very little accountability. Reckless driving is not a crime. So you can, unless you pretty much hit and kill somebody, it's or cause serious bodily injury or cause huge property damage, you're not criminally liable. Just going through a red light at 100 miles an hour or weaving in and out of traffic in order to create a hazard, it's not a crime. And it doesn't matter how many times you do it. What happens is you get a ticket. And as we have seen, people get tickets and they just don't pay them. And it doesn't matter. Many of course, the people who are driving recklessly, they don't have driver's licenses. Maybe they've never had one or it's been suspended. They don't have insurance on the cars. The plates probably aren't up to date. And all that happens is they get tickets and they never pay the tickets. Well, Jeff, how do you know they never pay the tickets? Well, I'm looking at a story from 2021 to 2022. The city issued 612 municipal citations for reckless driving. Would you like to guess what percentage of those tickets from 2022 have not been paid? So we got a whole world. The universe is 612 tickets. What percentage hasn't been paid? 10%, 20%, 50%? I'll save you the trouble. 82%. 82 out of every 100 tickets for reckless driving have not been paid. So in other words, the people who are driving recklessly just kind of laugh. They bunch up the ticket. They throw it in the back. Then they get another citation. It's for more money. Oh, this is your second reckless driving ticket. We're going to give you a fine for more money. Okay, great. Bunch that up and throw it in the back seat. Now, for many of us, you know, getting a ticket for reckless driving would be a big deal because we care about points on our driver's licenses. We care about, you know, our insurance status. Oh, my God, I got a ticket for reckless driving. Can you imagine what that's going to do to the insurance? But for a lot of the people that are the chronic reckless drivers, they don't care. And because you can't put them in jail for this, they really don't care. So there's new legislation that has been passed by the state. We talked about this, and yesterday a Milwaukee Common Council committee adopted this. So here's what can happen. Municipalities, and Milwaukee will be joining this, assuming the Common Council goes along with it and the mayor signs off. Municipalities can impound vehicles used in reckless driving, but there have to be three conditions that are satisfied. First of all, the driver has to be the owner of the vehicle. Secondly, the driver has to have a prior conviction for reckless driving. And third, the driver has not fully paid the fines associated with the previous conviction. So if you've got somebody that is a multiple reckless driver, hasn't paid the fines, and owns the car, In that case, they can take it. But here's the problem, and I'm not faulting the Common Council on this, because this is only as far as the state legislature went. But let's say somebody is driving, okay, you've got a guy who's driving a car and it's registered to his wife's name, or he's borrowed it from a buddy, or you've got somebody that's driving their parents' car or whatever, that they're not the owner of the car, but yet they're driving it with permission. Car cannot be impounded and cannot be towed. If the person doesn't have a prior conviction for reckless driving, it can't be towed. And as long as they have paid their fines for reckless driving, it can't be towed. My point would be, and by the way, I have no trouble with allowing people under these circumstances to have their cars towed, but my question is, why do we stop there? I mean, seriously, first time you catch somebody blowing through a red light at 100 miles an hour, now I believe it should be criminal. I've argued that before. I mean, I think that's really the only way to get people's attention. But why do we have to have all these conditions? If you catch somebody blowing through a red light at 100 miles an hour, in my example, why shouldn't you tow the car on the spot? Why do you have all these conditions? You tow the car on the spot. If it turns out to be a borrowed car or something like that, let the owner come back down, and in that case, the owner will have to pay the towing fines or whatever, because that's the only way you get the car back. If it's stolen, of course, you give it back to the owner. But I'm talking about situations where it's the car that either belongs to the person that's driving or has been borrowed by them. You tow the car. Because I guarantee you, if you lend somebody your car and they get caught driving through a red light at 100 miles an hour and you've got to go back and pay the towing fee and pay all this, you're never going to lend them that car again. Secondly, why do we have to wait? If you've got somebody, what difference does it make if they're paying their fines or not? If they're driving 100 miles an hour, why don't we just tow the cars? And then you can't get your car back until you go down and you pay the fines. Why do we have to give people multiple chances? 855-616-1620. And by the way, I have no problem with this ordinance. None at all. And Milwaukee is going as far as the legislature lets them go. My only point is, I don't think that's anywhere near far enough. So, very glad to have you with us. Okay, here is the real downside to having like the cameras in the studio with the watching live and stuff. It's because in 8 years doing a radio show in this market, I have never sneezed on the air. Never. I haven't said I've never sneezed, but it's not on the air because you can turn off your mic and so people don't know you're doing that. Well, I am in the early stages of a minor cold right now. And maybe you can hear just a little bit in my voice. Not bad, not enough to keep me from working. It's not COVID. It's nothing like that. It's just, I get springtime colds when it gets warm and then it gets cold. And so I'm in a little bit of one of those things, but I feel like this monster sneeze that is coming on. So that people will be watching that. And I'm like, okay, you're on the camera and now there's no way to get off the live stream because I'm not going to be able to signal my producer in time to say, kill the live stream feed. So that's kind of the other incentive. It's like, okay, we're going to watch the guy on radio and we'll see what happens. It's just all these little things that you don't think of until you recognize that you're being live streamed constantly. Here's a text. Happily retired police officer, Jeff. I can tell you how to cut down on reckless driving. Anytime somebody is stopped for any legitimate reason for traffic offense and they don't have a valid driver's license, tow the vehicle. I had to let people go hundreds of times after giving them a ticket for no insurance, for speeding, no driver's license, operating after suspended or revocation, and they just drive away from the traffic stop. How does that make any sense? We let them continue driving even though we know they have no driver's license. Now, that's crazy. I don't care whose vehicle it is. Once their friend's car gets towed or their parents' car gets towed numerous times, they're not going to borrow that car out to their friend or their kid any longer. You've got to make them pay for the towing for people to realize that they might not borrow the car out to a friend that doesn't have a driver's license. By the way, I agree with what the happily retired police officer is saying 100%, and that's kind of follows in the footsteps of what I was saying about this reckless driving thing. Why, as a starting point, why does it have to be your car that's towed? If you're driving a car in a reckless fashion, What difference does it make whether or not it's your car or whether you're driving your dad's car or whether you're driving your wife's, the car that's titled in your wife's name, or you're driving a friend's car that they've lent to you? Now, obviously, if it's a stolen car, that's a different thing. Then the car is going to be taken and pounded and it's going to be given back to the rightful owner. But if somebody has, if I'm stupid enough to lend my car to someone who then decides that they want to drive 100 miles an hour or run through a red light or something, I think the appropriate penalty is that car is going to be towed, and either I have to go down to pay it to get out of impound, or I've got to go to my buddy that I loaned it to and say, okay, you got to give me the money to get this out of impound. But you deter, I guarantee you, if they take, if I've lent my car to Charlie, who doesn't have a driver's license, in theory, in my example, and he blows through the red light and they've now towed my car down there, I'm going to think twice the next time Charlie says, hey, Jeff, can I borrow your car again? And I apologize for, he's looking at me like, why are you using me as the example? Well, it's just you happen to be the first person I saw. But you get the idea. That's the point. All right. Let us switch gears. As long as we're talking about crime problems, there's no secret that with the rise of internet shopping, with the rise of Amazon and so many things, it puts a strain on your traditional brick and mortar stores. And I admit I am guilty of this. I like to support like the local businesses. I do, because I understand they're paying property taxes, they're hiring people. At the same time, I admit I am a creature of convenience. I'll give you an example. I needed two new pairs of blue jeans. And so I know what the size of the blue jeans are. I know what the style of the blue jeans are. And rather than going around to a number of different stores in the hopes that they might have two pairs of the type of blue jeans I want in the size that I wear and the material that I want, I went on the website. I went on the Levi's website, and you just put a couple entries there. You say, this is what I want, and you order it, and it's going to be arriving at my house today, tomorrow, you know, whatever. It comes in a couple days. It's just that convenience. And if you're one of those people that like to shop, or you want to go out and you want to try things on, that's great. But I'm talking about blue jeans. I wear the same kind of blue jeans. I know what the size is. So it's just easier to order online. And that is the battle that the brick and mortar retailers face. Here's another battle that they face. And the headline that caught my attention is Target expands locked merchandise cases to hit back at shoplifting. And the story is that Target stores across the country, but in particular in New York and in San Francisco, what they are doing, because the shoplifting problem is so huge, what they are doing is they are keeping all items in the personal care aisle locked up. And so what they've done is they brought in those plastic, you know, clear plastic cases. And now, so instead of being able to, you know, walk through an aisle and take deodorant or shaving cream or, you know, whatever, razor blades or, you know, whatever you might want, soap, you're not able to do that anymore. It's all behind lock and key. And what you have to do is you go into Target, you have to track down an employee, and then you got to flag down the employee. And we know that all these stores have fewer employees nowadays. Got to flag down the employee. You got to get them to open up the case. And you have to say, okay, I want a thing of the Men in deodorant, and I want a thing of the Edge shaving cream, and I want give me some of that shampoo there. I like the Pert shampoo. You have to find somebody to get it for you. New York, they're also making rows and rows of their personal care selection locked up and requiring a staffer to open. And apparently, Target, they're saying, yeah, we're doing this, but we're also going to be putting more and more stuff behind lock and key. And the reason we have to do this is because we're getting killed by shoplifting. And we have a lot of these sort of professional thieves that come over and are stealing us blind. But that's our reaction to this. Now, I appreciate why Target is doing this. I get it. But at the same time, as a consumer, right, I want shopping to be easy. And there's nothing that could be easier, candidly, than going on to Amazon Prime and putting in, especially if you know what products you want, putting that in, doing the search, You'll find out what the price is, and they'll deliver it to your door that day or a day from now or 2 days from now, and you'll be good to go. And I guess if you get to a point where more and more stuff that you're used to just being able to go to the store, reach on the shelves and take it off, if it's behind lock and key, I just think more people are going to do one of two things. First of all, they're not going to shop at those stores where it's all locked up. And or secondly, they're going to turn to internet shopping. I understand why Target is doing this. I get it. But to me, this is another example why we have to crack down on shoplifters and say that this isn't going to be tolerated, because just as a typical consumer, I'm not going to flag somebody down every time I want to buy a couple bars of Irish Spring soap. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. All right, how far are you willing to go? And if the store that you're used to patronizing, you go in there and everything that you're used to just being able to pull off the shelf is now behind lock and key, is that going to make you change your shopping habits? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Jeff, why are we so soft on all crimes? Repeat reckless drivers, repeat shoplifters, repeat fill-in-the-blank criminals. That's what they are. They're criminals. Heavy fine, bill more jails. There's a couple ways to deter them. Well, this is the idea. And look, and I get it. You've got places like Target, and what they're doing is they're saying, hey, we cannot handle all the shoplifting that we've got going on now. So what we're doing is we're just going to have to put everything behind plexiglass cases. Well, okay, I understand why they're doing it. It's unfortunate they are, but how is that going to affect consumer choices? Because I don't know about you, but I'm not a shopper to begin with, but if I'm running in to buy some soap or to buy, you know, toothpaste or whatever, and I now have to flag down an employee to give me my thing of Colgate toothpaste, for goodness sakes, 855-616-1620. Let's start with Matt in Wautoma. Matt, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Well, hey, Jeff, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You know, I locked the whole store up. If there's one thing that was good that came out of the pandemic, it was the ability to place an order online and go pick it up, right? So if I place my order with Target, I got, you know, my list, and I place it online, that employee now has to go unlock all those doors, get all my stuff into one bag, and I come and I scoop it up.
Yeah.
Now, the other side to that, though, is that Amazon, well, yes, very good. Sometimes it's not the cheapest thing, right?
Yeah.
You sometimes get some of these brick-and-mortar stores, Home Depot, whatever it is, and you'll find they have the better deal. And, you know, it's a game, right? You got to go back and forth. But because of that convenience, I say lock it all up and do away with the whole process. Give me my online ordering. I'll take that all day.
Well, thanks for calling, Matt. I think, you know, it might end up coming to that. But I mean, here's part of the problem. I've got a text here. Jeff, Target doesn't have enough employees for this policy. I'm a former Target employee, and there were many Friday and Saturday evenings when I was the only one on the floor and with a list the length of my arm of tasks that I had to complete before closing, and also help every customer on the floor who needed it. It's just not going to happen. So, like in your scenario, can you imagine the situation where you don't have enough employees on the floor to begin with, and then you've got some people that are calling in their orders? And I just think as a practical matter, I understand that during the pandemic, this is what people were doing, but for these routine type of purchases, we're not talking about big ticket items, for the routine type of purchases that we're discussing, hey, I'm going to go in, I'm going to get some toothpaste, I'm going to get some Irish Spring soap or whatever, the idea that you're going to have people who are, I don't know, just going to stand around and try to flag down some employee to open this up, I just don't buy it. Let's talk to, we got Mike in Illinois. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
You know, I'm sitting here listening to the callers calling in and sitting here, and I'm like, I don't want to overgeneralize, but this seems to be a result of liberal policy, starting with not, you know, prosecuting for theft, allowing people to make more money not working than working, hence the less employees. And it's like there's a domino effect. And it's a shame that Target has to do this, but I don't blame them.
No.
But unfortunately, they'll probably end up having to close because they won't have enough employees or customers coming in anymore. So it's just a domino effect from not tackling the problem, just like the car theft in Milwaukee and Chicago and other places. It's just a result of not doing what they should do in the first place.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling, Mike. And I guess, see, that's the point I'm making. I don't fault Target for doing this. If they're getting ripped off, what's the phrase they use in the industry? It's shrinkage. Okay, that's what they call it. That's theft. And at a certain point, you know, if the theft gets out of control, that the stores have no choice but to close. That's what happened to the Walmart on 103rd and Silver Spring. They you know, and they weren't coming out and fully saying, but that was the problem. You know, once the theft gets over a certain point, because the markups are just what they are, that the store ends up losing money. And so, all right, you either have to control the thefts, and we don't have a willingness to do that, or what you have to do is you have to take what I will describe as draconian steps like this to lock everything up. And so I'm with you. I understand why the store is doing it. I am not angry at the store that they are doing it, but I am saying I just don't want to deal with that. I am not a shopper. I'm just not. I'm a buyer. If I want to run into a store, I want to get the things I need and then get out. And if the idea is, okay, I'm going to have to go into a store and I'm going to have to try to flag down some employee to ask for, you know, a thing of Colgate toothpaste and a thing of Irish Spring soap, it ain't going to happen. It's just not. And when you have the alternative that is out there, and the alternative is you go on your computer, you know what product you want. And see, this is where it really comes into play because, you know, for Target, what they're doing is they're locking up what they call the personal care section. Well, most of us, you know, we don't go and shop for different kinds of toothpaste tubes. I mean, you know, you use Crest, you use Colgate, you use whatever you use. It's not like, oh, gee, I want to go browse these different things. You know what you want. So you can go online and you can order what you have online if you want. Jeff, what's wrong with having receipts checked at the door? Honest customers won't have a problem with that. Well, that doesn't solve the problem that they have. Yes, they have some problems with small-time shoplifting, like people putting razor blades in their, you know, pockets and stuff like that. But the bigger problem, I think, is some of the theft organizations that go in and just take shopping carts full of stuff and then make a run for the door. And, of course, the problem is that the employees – and this is, you can argue about whether this is right or wrong or not, but the employees are instructed, okay, don't engage. You know, you've got the person that's stealing. Well, you know, we don't want you getting into a fight with them, and we don't want you pulling a gun, and we don't want you wrestling them down in the parking lot because that creates all sorts of liability. Jeff, what you're describing is another of the drip, drip, drips of our society and the daily lives slowly becoming unrecognizable. Well, I guess that's the point that is out there. Jeff, your last caller, Mike, is exactly right. They've this is a partly one of the reasons why you don't have enough people is that we've made it easy not to work. Jeff, I don't go to two Walgreens stores because they lock their stuff up. Well, I think that's the reality. Jeff, if you chase down the employee, they unlock the cabinet, they give you your razor blades, then you proceed to do the rest of your shopping in the store. What stops you from putting that package of razor blades in your pocket while you're shopping in the children's section? Well, you don't want to hear this, but some stores, what they will do with some items is they don't give them to you. The employees will walk up to, now I'm not saying they do this with razor blades or toothpaste, but sometimes what they will do is you say, okay, I want this item that's behind the plexiglass door, what they'll do is they'll say, okay, here's the deal. I will walk it up to the front register, and then you can pay for it, or we'll put it behind the front register, and then when you go up to check out, you can have it then. They don't even give it to you because it's so bad. All I'm saying is if you want to see brick-and-mortar stores survive, one of the things you got to do is recognize that the shoplifting is a huge problem, and we've got to start cracking down on it. Speaking of problems, right after the top of the hour news, I want to talk about cell phones in schools. Stick around. This is Jeff Wagner, WTMJ.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. So glad to have you with us. We just had a take your wife to work day. My wife was in town with a couple of her sisters, and they decided to stop off, and we had them in and took a couple photos, and that was kind of a fun thing to do. A number of people are saying, you guys are in the Avenue. Yes, we're in, it's the old Grand Avenue. It is the Avenue. We are off the food hall. We're at kind of, I think, the, sort of the west end of the food hall, but a lot of activity going on, and I was talking to the lady that was cutting my hair today. I said, I haven't been down there. I kind of remember the old Grand Avenue. I said, well, it's a completely different experience. There's no question about it. And there's less retail. There's more, corporations and more businesses that are in there. But there's this food hall that's really, it's got to be at least a dozen different places to eat, maybe more. And there's a couple bars and stuff. And there's all sorts of stuff going on. It really, when you talk about trying to plan a renaissance for an urban area, this is a poster child for how you can do it right. There's no question about that at all. All right. The story in the local newspaper, here's the headline. West Allis, West Milwaukee School District bans cell phones in intermediate and high schools in an effort to quell fights. Let me just leave that hang out there. In an effort to quell fights, the West Allis, West Milwaukee School District has banned the use of cell phones in its intermediate and its high schools. The school board decision reached at the end of March banned cell phones at the schools during the school day. The ban went into effect April 17th and will last through June 10th. The ban was adjusted at the end of April to allow high school students to use their cell phones during their lunch period while in the cafeteria. Cell phones were already banned at the elementary school level, and then the ban also prohibits students from using phones to record or instigate fights or share or post them on social media. So far this school year, the district has removed 26 students from its schools for involvement in major fights. 26 kids tossed out of school for involvement in major fights. 183 students cited at the district's secondary schools for violations to the law on school grounds. Then the story in the local newspaper goes on and describes the policy that they have at a number of other school districts. Wauwatosa, cell phones may not be used during the school day at the elementary level. In what world would you have fourth graders with cell phones? But apparently they say, no, you can't use them at the elementary school. You can't use phones above that if the phone disrupts the educational process. Middle and high school students are not allowed to use their devices during class, while high school level students have to get permission from their teacher. In Waukesha, the Waukesha School District, students may have cell phones on school property, vehicles, or at after-school activities. They may be stored out of sight during class, study hall, or other instructional time. All right. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, I fully recognize that I am a dinosaur when it comes to this, because I went to school before Al Gore had invented the internet and before there were cell phones. So if you had to call home during the school day or had to call somebody, what you would do is they had pay phones at different places, and you would go to these things that we called pay phones, where you would take out a dime or a quarter or whatever they were, and you'd put the money in and you'd actually kind of like dial the number. If your parents needed to get in touch with you during the school day, they would call the school office. And then somebody from the school office would come down and they'd pull you out of class and they'd say, okay, your parents are coming over to pick you up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever that would be. That's how it used to be. Now, I understand that those days, that ship has sailed. I get it. I understand that we're never going to necessarily go back to that. But there's no question in my mind that if you're in school, it would seem to me that you are supposed to be in school. And whether it's elementary school or middle school or high school, having a cell phone and using a cell phone during the school day should always be inappropriate. I'm looking at the story in the local newspaper, and some parents are saying, well, my child likes to sit in the library and listen to music, while he's reading and stuff. Look, I think the only policy to have with this, and I'm not saying you have to confiscate the cell phones, for example, at the door, But the policy should be if the kid, whatever their age is, brings a cell phone to school, that cell phone has to be kept in the student's locker. And then, you know, if you want to have a policy where, okay, at lunch hour, you can go and you can retrieve the cell phone from your locker and you can be on the cell phone at lunch. If you want to do that, that's okay. But then the cell phone's got to go back in the lockers because kids, at least it seems to me, cell phones are a distraction. They have the potential to cause some of these problems. And I don't even want to argue about whether or not, you know, a 10-year-old needs to have a cell phone at school. But it's certainly, I think, fair to say if your parents, you decide you want to let the kid bring the cell phone to school, the cell phone goes in the locker and it stays in the locker. So in that case, if there is some sort of emergency and the kid needs to call home or something like that, well, they can have access to it with appropriate permission. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. If we're going to allow cell phones in school, is it reasonable to say, okay, we're going to put restrictions on this, and one of those restrictions are you come into school, the cell phone goes in the locker, it stays in the locker till the end of the school day, and the very, very rare situation where you might need it for the emergency, okay, then you get permission from the teacher or from the assistant principal or whatever, you can go retrieve the cell phone, you can make the call, and then boom, the cell phone goes back in. Is that an unreasonable position? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Day. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. All right. A number of these different school districts are grappling with what's the appropriate cell phone policy, because the problem is that you let the kids have the cell phones, and first of all, it is a distraction. It takes away from what the schools are trying to do. And in some cases, like in West Milwaukee, apparently, it's been a source of problems because what happens is you get a fight that breaks out. Somebody gets on the cell phone. Hey, there's a fight that breaks out, and they send out, put something on social media using their cell phone. Next thing you know, everybody's rushing, including relatives are coming in, and the fight ends up getting out of control. I think there's a real easy solution to it, and simple solution would be to we're going to ban cell phones in the classrooms during the school day. But if you're not willing to do that, that the secondary thing would be you bring a cell phone to school, but you can't have it on your person. It goes into the locker, and then if the school wants to allow you to take it out at lunch and you can use it in the cafeteria, then it goes back into the locker. It's about time. Here's a tech, but it's about time. All school districts need to do this. Phone use in classrooms is disruptive, unnecessary, and now that kids use them to post school situations online and even summon often outsiders to come to the school to provide reinforcements to conflicts, phones need to stay in lockers until the end of the day. I agree with that completely. I've got a couple other texts, though, which articulates the extreme. For example, one of our listeners from Wauwatosa says, Jeff, parents will never agree to not having phones on students' person due to the school shooting issue. Parents want to be in constant contact with their child should something like this happen. All right. And that's, I guess that's the issue that you have to confront. If we agree that cell phones on kids' persons is in general at school, it's a disruption. And it's a bad idea. It is a disruption. It is unnecessary with this little, I'm making my air a little asterisk here. It's a disruption. It is unnecessary to the function of the school. It is a distraction. It can be a problem. So let's accept that, because I think you can't argue with that. The only countervailing argument to that would be exactly that. Well, there is that one in a million chance that you're going to have that school shooting situation and that the parents are going to want to be in contact with their kid when the school shooting circumstances has happened. And so the argument, I guess, is that one, thankfully, that one in a million chance that something like that could happen, does that, and then, you know, what's the kid necessarily going to do with the cell phone? But I understand it keeps the parents in touch. I get it. In that situation, do I concede that the cell phone may be useful? Yes, I do. I'll concede that. But I guess to me, the issue is that one in a million or more chance, and that's as terrible as school shootings are, and I understand they happen, but given all the schools that we have around the country, and given the fact that, you know, on a daily basis, nothing like this happens, the fact that you might have a school shooting somewhere, sometime, does that, and in that particular situation, you want the kid to be able to phone out to the parents and say, I'm okay, I'm on a different level than this. Is the rare, and thankfully it's extremely rare, is the very, very rare chance that something like that would happen, is that sufficient to justify all the problems that having, you know, cell phones on kids' persons have? And in my position, like I say, I'm not even saying you couldn't have the cell phone in the school. I'm just saying it has to be in the locker. So on that very, very rare chance that something like Uvalde is going to happen, and thankfully that doesn't happen with any degree of regularity, it is still the extreme situation, and that's fine, and that's good. We're glad that it's like that. But does the daily problems that cell phones cause, does that justify the fact that, well, maybe you've got the emergency, the extreme situation, and you might need it for that, so we'll live with all the rest of this here. 855-616-1620. Jeff, are cell phones used as a teaching tool by teachers? Well, I don't know if this is an option, but looking up information in an encyclopedia is outdated. Well, okay, most of the kids, I don't think they're using their personal cell phones in class for that. First of all, most like kids get laptops or they get the iPads or whatever. I guess it's one thing if you're going to have a class and here we're going to expect you to use your personal cell phone to, you know, do research for the class in the course of the classroom. But I think that doesn't happen with any degree of regularity either. And I guess if it does, then you can make an exception for that. But what about the kids that don't have cell phones? I mean, that would be my question. So I think that's just the justification for this, saying, okay, we're going to let the kids have this, and we're going to be able to, and we're going to be willing to, you know, live with this. Jeff, I don't think school shootings are extremely rare anymore. Well, they are. I mean, statistically speaking, and I'm not downplaying the significance of when a school shooting occurs. It is a big deal. But if you look at how many schools there are in the country and how, you know, 5 days a week, and we're talking kindergartens and elementaries and secondary schools and the middle schools, yes, I mean, a school shooting situation is rare. So for that handful of times it's going to happen, you know, do you justify all these other problems? Do we say, well, you know, they have to have this because you might be in that nightmare scenario. Well, that's kind of a weird argument to have. It's kind of like saying, okay, well, you know, every time you fly on a plane, we better give you a parachute because there might be that time when the plane's engines die or something. It doesn't happen in the real world with any degree of regularity. But the question becomes, how far do you go with this? Somebody saying, well, gun violence is a killer of children. It has nothing to do with gun violence. We're talking about cell phones in schools, for goodness sakes. I'm all in favor of doing all sorts of things to stop gun violence among kids, starting with, you know, again, going after people that shouldn't have guns and metal detectors in the schools and things like that. But I'm sorry, arguing to me that, well, if we have cell phones in the schools, that's going to reduce gun violence. That's just an explanation. That's just a justification to try to say, well, we want the kids to be able to have the cell phones to play around on them. Jeff, you shouldn't send your kid to school if you're that worried about their safety. A phone is not protection from students. Jeff, if the teachers have a cell phone in the classroom, the kids can contact their parents. Well, I think there is that element to that. I mean, no question about it. I mean, as long as the teachers have it, there will be the way it does it. Jeff, bans don't work. Bad kids will still do bad things. The only kids hurt by this are the good kids. Okay, well, I guess why do you need, in the daily course of events, why do you need a cell phone in school? I mean, you don't. I mean, if you're in the classes You know, why do you need to be texting your friends? Well, no, you don't. Do you need to be calling your buddies? Do you need to be surfing the internet? And the answer is no, you don't need to do that. I appreciate that there will be the occasions when you need to call mom and dad or whatever. And if you got the cell phone in the locker, that's okay. You're able to do that. If the school wants to let you have it during your lunch hour, I'm okay with that as well. But the argument that, well, there might be that one in a million school shooting and you need that cell phone to get in touch with mom and dad, I'm sorry, I don't think that's enough of a justification to overcome the problems that cell phones cause. Let's sneak in one call before the bottom of the hour news. Lamar in Orlando, Florida. Lamar, good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This struck a chord with me. I taught for a very short period of time here in Florida, and cell phones were the absolute bane of my existence. And so in my classroom, I had an outright ban. And for the parents that challenged me with this whole idea of that one emergency that never happened, you know, I let them know, listen, not only were they a distraction, because you're telling teenagers not to be on their cell phones, right? That's the rule. They're not going to listen.
Right.
They're going to be on social media, they're going to be recording. And when incidents happen, that just heightens their wanting to be performative. You know, if you got a phone, it just heightens. If you have a regular argument, the phones come out, they know they're on social media, it's just going to make them worse.
Yeah.
And so I had an outright ban. And this idea of searching for information, just to kind of lay the setting, in Florida, or at least here in Central Florida, students are given laptops.
Right.
So if they want to search for information, they have laptops with internet.
Right.
So they don't need the phones. They're more trouble than worse.
Okay, Lamar, let me get a handful of texts from people. Jeff, you clearly don't have kids. You don't understand if there's something where the school needs to be evacuated, we need the kids to be able to get in touch with us immediately. That's the argument.
In Orlando, again, this is, and I'm going to look at this situation and how they communicate. If something is going wrong, the school sends out a mass text to parents.
Right.
Or emails to parents, and they're calling parents. The communication is there, and there's phones in every classroom. So it's not like parents are in the dark.
Right.
And if parents want to make that argument, fine. Give them regular cell phones, that no smartphones then. Give them flip phones. If they need to communicate you.
Right, that badly. Yeah, thanks for calling. I don't think we can, this idea that there may be, the world could be ending. All right, you might have this catastrophic situation, and in that 1 in 20 million chance, and you need that instant communication, and you're exactly right, why does it have to come from the kids? Let's say the school is being evacuated because somebody smelled gas. Okay, and so all the kids are being taken to, you know, the neighboring middle school or whatever. Okay, the school is going to communicate that. The school will communicate it. Why do the individual parents need to have the cell phones and the kids for that one in a million plus chance, given all the other problems that cell phones cause? And I guess if you're that afraid of sending your kid out into the real world that something bad might happen and they're not able to directly communicate with you immediately, maybe you should consider not sending the kid out into the world. Okay, so I understand that lots of people get security clearances, and I understand that it's tough to monitor all of them. At the same time, this story about this guy that leaked over a course of months and months and months all these top secret documents that did have the impact of undermining U.S. foreign policy, and who knows how much damage what this 21-year-old guy, Jack Texeira, has done. And he's going to have to face the music. And my guess is he's going to be in prison for 5, 10, 15 years once this is all said and done. And he deserves all that. But moving forward, to me, the question is, how could something like this happen? And what do we need to do to prevent it in the future? Now, it's starting to come out that back when this guy was in high school, he apparently was suspended after a classmate overheard him making remarks about weapons, including Molotov cocktails, guns at schools, and racial threats. This episode prompted Massachusetts authorities to twice deny him a firearms identification card, a license to possess and carry guns issued by local police department. Okay, so here you have a guy when he's in high school, they've already red flagged him as a problem, so he can't get guns. So he joins the military, and next thing you know, he's got a security authorization, a top secret security clearance, which allows him to access documents that he has no business looking at. And then somehow he's able to, again, copy these documents and put them out on the internet, and nobody catches him. Now, I think it's interesting because one of the arguments that's made is, well, you have to understand the Army needs, you know, all these, the Army needs all these different people to work at the jobs. We've got about 75,000 jobs that require security clearance, and about 65 to 70% of these jobs are in information technology or engineering. So you're going to get young people who are going to come in and they're going to apply for these jobs, and they need to have some access to confidential documents. I get it. I understand that. But it seems to me there's security clearances and there's security clearances. And it's one thing to say to somebody, okay, your job with the Massachusetts Air National Guard is you're responsible for, you know, an IT job. And your job is to make sure that the internet doesn't crash or whatever that is. That's different than saying, all right, you've got this, we're going to give you access. So your job gives you access to get into our computer system. Okay, that's fine. But is it unreasonable to expect that there's going to be people that are going to monitor what it is that you do with that? And just because you have access to get into government computers, I guess what's troubling to me is there's apparently nobody watching. Once somebody gets this access, they can access anything that's out there, including stuff that has nothing to do with their job and nothing to do with anything related to what their job should be. And then apparently, like this guy, he's not only able to just get in and start to troll through all sorts of intelligence reports that have nothing to do, again, with what he's doing for the Air National Guard, but he's able to access the documents. Nobody is able to track. Nobody apparently watches that. Why is a guy in Massachusetts with the Massachusetts Air National Guard downloading, I don't know, documents, downloading and looking at intelligent documents submitted by the CIA regarding something going on in Afghanistan or Ukraine or whatever? That there's nobody saying, why is somebody going and accessing these documents? Then it gets even crazier that it's not only accessing the documents, but apparently he's like printing them out and then taking them out of secure facilities and taking pictures of them. You would think that there would be somebody somewhere, some red flag that goes off and says, we've got this guy with the Massachusetts Air National Guard who has now logged onto some system. He's looking at documents pertaining to what's going on with Russia, and he's looking at intelligence with what goes on in Russia, and we think he's now downloaded some of that, or he's copied it. Can our system be this bad that there's not some red flag that goes off, that there's not some supervisor somewhere going, hey, why was Jack trolling through CIA reports, you know, involving Ukraine? Or why was Jack looking at intelligence regarding France and Russia's dealings? Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I guess the more I read about this character and all the red flags, they thought he was too dangerous to give him a gun license when he was in high school, but instead the U.S. government gives him a security clearance and just sends him loose, turns him loose on the entire intelligence community, and nobody monitors him. I guess what's striking to me about this is the complete and total lack of checks and balances. And I understand the argument that says, well, look, we got to hire IT people. And if we're going to hire IT people, you know, and their job is to make sure that our computer systems are up and running, you know, that they've got to be able to have access to those computer systems. Okay, I get that as far as it goes. but the fact that once you give somebody access to it, there's apparently nobody looking at what some 21-year-old guy at the Massachusetts Air National Guard Wing is doing, what intelligence he's accessing, what he's doing with that, and there's nobody out there saying, hey, there's some red flag. Every time it would seem to me that you log onto some, I don't know, classified sort of document, there should be something going off somewhere that a whole bunch of people who need to have access to that information see, so they could say, why is this guy doing this? What is he doing? And maybe we need to send a follow-up. And as far as his frontline supervisors, I understand that a couple of them have been demoted, court-martialed, transferred, whatever, because clearly there was no direct supervision. But it seems to me this is a complete and total systems failure. Isn't there a way we can do better? I don't know what our different protocols are here, but I guarantee you, if I had somehow, I'm limited into what I can access in our computer system. I can access stuff that pertains to me using my passcode. But you would think that there would be something that if somebody, I don't know, who works in IT, for example, is somehow starting to access people's financial information or something like that, that there'd be a red flag somewhere where somebody says, why is that guy in IT? Why is Jeff? Why is he logging on and looking at payroll information for all the employees? I don't claim to be a computer pro, but this doesn't seem to me like it's rocket science. And apparently the government continues to be vulnerable. Or is this just a situation where there's nothing we can do? Now, I refuse to accept that. But, some people are just saying, well, there's nothing we can do because, you've got to have access to this stuff. 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. See, and my concern about talking about this leak is not that they caught the guy that's done it, but once you have this leak, that the damage is done. And I guess my concern is, what are we going to do moving forward to stop it from happening again? And again, I don't claim to be an IT specialist, but it is mind-boggling to me that you can have somebody from the Massachusetts Air National Guard who couldn't get a firearms license because he was so weird in high school that he's at the age of 21 is able to get access to our top secret stuff and visit it time after time after time, and then somehow print it up and then somehow put it out on the internet. There's got to be a better way, doesn't there? Let's talk to Tim and Shawno. Tim, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
So I was in the military for 20 years, and I actually had a top secret security clearance, and I worked on those types of programs. And I think there's two failure points here that you discussed when you were bringing up this topic that I think need to be expanded further. One is, how did he get the top secret security clearance to begin with? Well, you mentioned about him being weird in high school, and the fact of the matter is that he got red flags, so he couldn't purchase a gun, but within the full breadth of the documents to file, there's a lot of documents and a lot of things you have to put in there, and a lot of it is me inputting that data. So if somebody needs to get interviewed, I am putting the person that needs to go get interviewed, right? If there is a background check, well, they're looking at my criminal history, right?
Right.
Did just because he was red flagged not to get a gun, did he in fact have a criminal record? If he didn't, that would be an oversight, and it could be overlooked, and he could get that, that security clearance. The second component
Tim, that doesn't make me feel any better. when the guys, he's on the internet, right, making threats and talking about racist stuff and all, and that wouldn't be flagged. That does not make me feel any better. Yeah.
Yeah, when they go through the interview process, your application gets parceled out to several different people that work for a company that is contracted through the government. Each one of these individuals had to submit a report, and then that is the culmination of the information that's provided.
Right.
And I'm concerned right now as to has the process not caught up with the times, right?
Yes.
Are we
yes.
not, taking a look at other things,
yes.
Outside of a criminal record and the people that I put on that interview, right?
Yes, right.
So You know, I think that's one component to it. And then the other component is, like, when, you know, when I had my security clearance, I worked in an organization that had all sorts of top secret programs. I only had access to the program that I was responsible for.
Yes.
I had no other access. I couldn't, like, if I printed something off, like, my chain of command knew what I was printing off because it went into this computer system, this database. So I think we're talking about multiple failures here, and not just the kid is accountable, but there's other people that are going to be need to be held accountable as well.
Yeah, and not to oversimplify it, but what you just said makes sense. If I mean, I understand he's an IT and he's got to have sort of access to something, but you know, it would seem to me you have access to your particular project, not being able to. You just scroll through all the confidential stuff and look at CIA reports involving, you know, Russia when it has nothing to do with what you're doing. You'd think that there'd be some red flag that would go up somewhere saying, we got this guy in Massachusetts who's accessing, you know, CIA reports or NSA reports or whatever it might be. You'd think that somewhere, somehow, that would be red flagged and somebody would say, why is he doing this? Why does he have access to this that has nothing to do with what his mission is?
Yeah, I would bet you that there probably were red flags, but people just ignored it. They just didn't, you know, they thought, why is, you know, this private, low ranking person accessing this? And they just kind of went about their day. I truly feel that that is very easy to occur, you know.
Tim, thanks for the perspective, and that doesn't make me feel any better either. Jeff, I'm a registered nurse. Every hospital I've worked at has a policy that you can't look at your own or a coworker's medical chart, and if you do, it will be detected, and security and your manager will immediately walk you out of the building. Same with HIPAA for patients' charts who you shouldn't be in. How can the government, military, not have a policy on par that's not stronger than that? Well, I'm sure they have a policy. I'm amazed that people didn't detect this. Sean in Janesville, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Sean.
I'm a 30-year IT network engineer, and I agree with the last caller on the first portion, on the first component, which is the background checks. A large part of IT in general for the government, whether it's state government or federal government, is outsourced, and it's outsourced through recruiting agencies. And there's a number of reasons they do that. Sometimes they import H-1B visas, and other times they don't want to give the full benefits and retirement that they give to a normal employee, so they bring in contractors. We understand how that works, but in that process, of course, the backgrounds are not as thorough as they should be. And like the previous caller said, if they didn't actually commit a crime, but they were just flagged for some behavioral things, especially if they were under 18, then they became an adult, those things would be missed. The other component I'd like to bring up just for clarity, and I'll use your example in the hospital. So I've worked in a number of hospitals and nuclear plants and some other government agencies. When you're in a hospital and you have HIPAA regulations, you're right in the department. If you're in oncology or you are in the cardiac unit or you're in dialysis, you can't cross into different departments. But if you're an IT person, you're tasked with supporting, say, dialysis and cardiac and oncology and the human resources department, you're going to have access to not only what those employees have, you're going to have access to
the whole system.
They have access to this. Right. So that would include. Now, what you asked earlier before the first caller was, is there a way to do it? Yeah, there is a way to do it. But we're talking about a company the size of, say, John Deere or General Motors or a huge corporation, it's a nightmare to implement a policy like that where you flag every piece of access for people that have different access to the system. For something even larger than that, like governments, the bureaucracy that's involved in the cross-departmental communication that's involved, you're talking about creating another arm of security, not just cybersecurity, but maybe an internal type of security that not only looks at, you know, what's happening with comings and goings of the particular, you know, corporation, but what's happening inside, what data is being transferred back and forth, and then to flag it accordingly, and then to...
But Sean, we're kind of up against the clock, but is the alternative then just to do nothing, just to say, okay, we're going to allow our deepest secrets to be at the mercy of some 21-year-old kid who's obviously got all sorts of issues? I mean, can't we... There has to be something you can do to stop...
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. What I've been crying about for a long time, like I said, 30 years in IT, I saw a change in the early 2000s, especially after 9/11. Up to the 90s when we were doing IT, you hardly ever heard of a breach or a hack.
Yeah.
As we approached into the new millennium, you started seeing more and more of them. And then 2005, 2006, we heard about the biggest Office Depot one, the Target one, and some other. Now, in the last 10 years, we've had, Experian, the credit one was hacked.
Sean, hey, but I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm running late because I've got to hit the news. I'm a little bit late for it, but I do appreciate the perspective. And I guess, look, I don't claim to be a software engineer, and I don't know, there's got to be some way that we just don't throw up our hands and say, look, and I understand if you're in IT and you've got to have access to these networks, there's got to be some way that we can red flag, 19 or 20-year-old kids who get jobs, and just because their job is in IT, that gives them access to all the nation's secrets, and then they're just able to kind of, this is how I'm going to spend Friday night. I'm going to read CIA documents or NSA documents on what's going on in Ukraine. There's got to be a better way. That's all I'm saying.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Greg Matzek, I asked you to hang around for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
First of all, you completed your 100 holes of golf yesterday.
Yes, and it was a wonderful day, too. It was a great weather day and a lot of money raised, over $236,000 raised by the 20 players who participated yesterday. And I'm happy to say that our total reached just over $8,500 here, my personal landing
page. That's very good.
Which means I'll be growing my hair back for the next month.
That's it.
And we look forward to that.
That kind of like a chia pet. You know,
right.
We'll be kind of like,
I'm not sure what to expect.
Taking a look at that. Okay, I asked you to stick around because a couple of sports news. First of all, I was checking this morning as well. The baseball season is a month in, and the Pittsburgh Pirates are leading the National League Central Division.
Not only that, they have the best record in the National League.
The Pittsburgh Pirates.
And
the Brewers, they're 7 games over 500. The Brewers hit a little rocky patch the last two home series. But nevertheless, the Brewers are doing, they're 16-9 or something like that. But the Pirates, what's going on with the Pirates?
So Pirates, Braves, Brewers, the three best records in the National League, just like we all expected. You might expect to see the Braves there, but I would argue that many didn't expect to see the Brewers where they're at this point. Just a lot of unknowns, and now they're dealing with injuries, but still, I think, performing rather well. I don't know what to make of the Pirates because everything pointed to a team that had some high-end talent, and they just signed Brian Reynolds, one of their premier players, to a nine-figure deal, which is big-time money. But it also pointed to them being a sort of a rebuilding team.
Yeah, sure.
So and maybe sell off at the trade deadline, get some more young players and prospects. Like, that's just kind of how it's been for them more often than not. But Andrew McCutchen, the former Brewer, is having a good year.
Right.
Reynolds is having a good year. I mean, really everybody when you have this kind of record. So, no, I did not expect this.
Right. And, of course, it is early. And that's the thing about a 162-game season. Stuff has a way of evening it out.
Yeah, check it at Flag Day. We'll see where the Pirates are.
Right. And, of course, St. Louis Cardinals. The Cardinals are in last, I think, as I look. I think they're worse than the Cincinnati Reds, I think.
Well, you're right on that. So I would say the Cubs are exceeding expectations. I would say the Brewers and Pirates are. Cardinals are certainly falling short of expectations. But as you say, it's not yet Mother's Day. That's one of your first check-in days on the Major League Baseball season because they got a long way to go. And I would be shocked if the Cardinals finished sub 500 and didn't find a way to make some noise here at some point.
You know, I have a 20 pack of season tickets. I really like the balanced schedule this year. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, in years past, it was every other game you went to was either the Pirates or the Cubs or the Cardinals or the Reds, you know. But now, I mean, the games I've been to, the Red Sox and the Tigers and, you know, opening day and things like that. It's fun to see different teams.
There's a variety of things happening in Major League Baseball right now. And now that they've been implemented, you feel the fans saying, well, what took so long? Right, so the pitch clock, the games
like
are going faster. No doubt about that. You're getting home. You're getting back and you're getting your kids to school the next morning, and it's not that big of a rush or a hassle. So that's a wonderful thing. But you're right. The balance scheduling, I think, is interesting because, you know, it's fun to go to a Brewers-Cubs game, but 18 of them, right? And just that can be reduced, and it is now.
Right.
And now you've got Shohei Ohtani, to me, just the best player in baseball.
Right.
He's not going to pitch this series against the Brewers, but if you don't know much about Shohei Ohtani, he's a pitcher, and he's an offensive player, and he's a Cy Young caliber pitcher and an MVP candidate offensive player. He's going to be in Milwaukee this weekend.
Right, and under the schedule, they're going to be there every other year. I mean, that's what I like.
No, so it's nice.
No, I think it's fan-friendly, and I do like the pitch clock. That was one of the things that I'm old school, but you'd go to these Tuesday night games or these Wednesday evening games, and it would start at 7 o'clock, and it's 7:10, and 9:30, and they're in the fifth inning, and you see all these people who brought kids there. They're leaving because they got to go to work the next day or whatever. It's just... And in these games that are 2.5 hours or 3 hours at the outset, that's it. That's a great time.
So things are happening quicker. You're not going to your phone as much at a game. You're not yawning your way through games.
Right.
If it is a 1-0 game, there's not a lot of offense. Likely that's going to be over somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 hours and 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Right.
And if you do get a lot of runs, you might have a 3-hour game, but you've also been entertained by a 10-7 game or whatever it ends up being.
No, I'm a big winner. Okay, before I let you go, let's flip the script. The Packers yesterday, end up picking the defensive end from Iowa. Some of the comment, it's one of those things that everybody's got an opinion, and it's always, well, I don't think that was a great deal. I thought it was a fine pick. I thought it was a solid pick.
Yeah, so his name is Luke Van Ness, and he's a redshirt sophomore, so he's pretty young. He's only 21 years old, which means he's got a long way to go in his NFL career if he can stay healthy. That's great. The Packers like drafting young. Kenny Clark was the youngest player in the draft when they drafted him. Randall Cobb was one of the youngest players in the draft when they drafted him. He's 6'5", 270 pounds. He came to Iowa a few years ago at 220 pounds, so he put on good weight. He's still running good times, still getting to the quarterback. People will say, well, why didn't he start at Iowa? He didn't start a single game at Iowa. But he played over 1,000 snaps, and his production was strong.
Because the Iowa head coach just... like play seniors.
They
right?
they kinda... tend to lean toward fifth year seniors and players in their fourth year. But Van Ness did see plenty of the field. What I see is an elite athlete. His numbers are incredible at the combine, but beyond that, he also had production to back it up. At a premier position, you have to find a way to get to the quarterback in the NFL. And the Packers put a lot of premium on that position.
And it's a position of need for the Packers as well with the linebacker Gary probably out to the middle of the year.
Yeah.
They need a pass rush.
So he tore his ACL. So last year the Packers were among the best in the league at getting to the quarterback, second best in the league until Gary got injured. And then they plummeted to the 28th spot in that category. So there's a premium on finding guys with that level of athletic ability who can get to the quarterback. And they prioritize that over a wide receiver or tight end, who you might see taken here on day two. Remember, they have picks number 42 and 45. Three picks in the top 50, that's pretty good real estate right there. Those are meant to be impactful players.
So do they go to offense, or is it best player available? What do you think happens?
So I'm always conflicted when I hear Brian Gutekunst say, we'll take the best player available, because I think there also is a mesh point of the intersection of best player available also meeting a significant need for the foreseeable future. But the Packers have so many needs. Tight end is a glaring need. They really don't have anybody you've ever heard of able to catch passes from Jordan Love. So that's a problem. I do think they'll draft a quarterback because they only have two rostered right now, and one may not end up making the team. His name is Danny Etling.
Right.
You don't want to see Danny Etling on the field during the regular season. So safety is another position they could add to. Always good to add to the offensive line. They've done historically very well in the middle rounds with that. So it's starting off to, it's shaping up anyway, like a Packers draft, right?
Right. And
elite
defensive
power.
And it could be anything because, like you say, there's so many needs. You know, it's just find somebody that can fit in.
The draft is a fun time, though. So they entered the draft with 11 picks, and I would be surprised if they didn't move around a little bit and try and get some more swings.
Interesting. Greg Matzik, and you can hear him, of course, on Wisconsin's Afternoon News and on all sorts of other things. We're going to take a quick break. Back with more in just a minute. Yeah, a little bit of sports on there. The Pittsburgh Pirates, 1 month, and again, I understand it's a really, really long season, and I will be surprised if the Pittsburgh Pirates are at the top at the, you know, roll mid-September. But still, it's sort of interesting, and it's kind of fun to me to see teams like Pittsburgh or like the Brewers, these so-called small, you know, market teams who are able to do well. Okay, Pop Culture Corner coming up in about 15 minutes. Before that, we mentioned this, earlier this week, for the U.S. Postal Service is getting ready for the second time this year to raise the cost of what they call the forever stamps, the first class stamps. At the beginning of the year, it was 60 cents. It went up to 63, and it's going up to 66 cents relatively soon if it hasn't already. But, 66 cents And the reason they need to do that, of course, is that the, you know, Postal Service, the costs that they are incurring have been increasing. And the simple fact is also that the fewer and fewer people are using, say, the first class mail option. And I'm guilty of this. And I say guilty. I used to, I mean, I would probably, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I would probably end up writing out just for different bills and things. I'd probably be sending out certainly 15, you know, first class letter, not necessarily letters, but, you know, bills. I'd be using the mail to pay the bills. Now I can count on one hand and actually on a couple fingers the number of bills that I actually pay via the mail. Almost everything that I do, almost, is based, it's just either the money automatically comes out of my bank account, or alternatively, I go in and I instruct, you know, somebody to deduct it from my bank account. The only bill that I have paid, I was thinking in the last couple months by sending via the mail, has been, I got the annual bill for the homeowner's insurance, and that came the other day, and I don't have that set up on direct pay. I pay once a year, so got the thing in the mail, wrote out the check, put it in the mail. But otherwise, I'm not using that much. So I went out the other day and I bought a whole bunch of these forever stamps, and I got in at the 63-cent because it's going up to 66 cents. And my guess is the stamps I purchased, are probably going to last me, I think I bought 3 books of them. I think they're going to last certainly a year, maybe more than that. And I've heard a lot of people complaining about, well, they keep jacking up the rates. They keep charging more and more. You know, and I keep thinking, though, you know, you can, for 66 cents, You can drop an envelope in a mailbox in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Key West, Florida, and that piece of mail, let's say you address it to somebody who lives in Portland, Oregon, or Bellingham, Washington, or Anchorage, Alaska, and that's going to be delivered for 66 cents. That's a pretty darn good deal. So for people who complain about the cost of, for example, first-class mail, I still think it's about as good a deal as we have going. And I at least believe that there's going to continue to be a need for mail. I think, you know, the amount of people that send stuff via first-class mail is going to continue to decline. There's no question about it, especially since, you know, younger people are probably more and more computer savvy. Like I said, I think I've only sent out, you know, one check in the physical mail in the last couple months. My guess is there's some of you who just don't do that at all. Your system's completely wired that way. But I guess, you know, for people who are complaining about the Postal Service and the cost of mail, I still think it's the best deal going, and I think it's an amazing bargain. Our number, 855-616-1620. All right, they've raised their rates. You have a problem with this? I mean, they've raised their rates, and quite candidly, they're probably going to continue to raise their rates. One of the great deals, though, is with these forever stamps. You know, they're good forever. So, like I said, I bought a bunch at 63 cents a stamp. My guess is that's going to probably last me a couple years. I don't have a problem with the Postal Service charging me a few cents more. 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Jeff, it's popular to diss the United States Postal Service, but it's not warranted. It's an amazing bargain. A live person comes to your house every day and delivers your letter anywhere in the United States. It is. And they'll do it for 63 cents. And it's going up July 9th is the date. It's going up to 66 cents. So one of our texters says, why did Jeff go out and buy books of stamps just to save 3 cents? Well, what I really did is I went out because I was out of stamps and I didn't want to have to. I had some time. I was at the post office. I didn't want to be running there all the time. So now the stamps I bought, I think, are probably a 2 or 3 year supply of them. But again, with these forever stamps, that doesn't matter. There can be other increases and stuff. The stamps that I purchased are still good. Dennis in Milwaukee. Dennis, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff. I agree completely with the text message you just read. You have a live person coming to your house every day. And what a lot of people don't realize is the post office delivers to every single corner address of the country, yep, a requirement that United Parcel Service and Federal Express doesn't have. And then an interesting story. Usually when I send items that have to be packed securely, I'll go to United Parcel Services because they'll pack it for you. Well, I went there a couple weeks ago to mail something. They did the usual nice job. And then the clerk commented that this package will be shipped by the post office. So UPS uses the post office as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, exactly. Thanks for calling. And it is just kind of amazing that, and I understand I've got a couple of texts saying, well, okay, the service has decreased. It's taken an extra day or so. But I'm still, you can walk to a mailbox in Key West, Florida, the southernmost part in the country, and you can address something to Anchorage, Alaska. And for 66 cents, they're going to deliver it. Jeff, I'm a letter carrier, and whenever people complain about the increase, I ask them who else will take their mail across town, much less across the country for that price, and then I tell them I'm worth it. Absolutely. You know, and our letter carrier, actually, this is the thing. Our dog loves the letter carrier. And so when the little mail truck pulls up and we walk Sasha out, this is the type of service you get. And I hope I'm not sure. I hope I'm not telling tales out of school. But if he's got a minute, he'll get out of the truck and pet the dog. This is and she just absolutely loves it. Love our letter carrier. It's a best bargain going. All right. Something else that's a great bargain. Pop Culture Corner and the Palermo's Pizza Prize Package coming up.
Gather round, all. It's time for Wagner's Pop Culture Corner. Time to put aside the heavy lifting and have a good time at the old National Bank Talkin' text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank, get old. Now, here's Jeff Wagner.
And, of course, Pop Culture Corner is sponsored by our friends at Palermo's Pizza. This is the way it works. One caller. Got to be a caller, not a texter. We'll read lots of texts, of course. But one caller during this segment in the exclusive discretion of my producer, Charlie, wins our Palermo's Pizza prize package, which is a coupon good for a couple Palermo's Pizza frozen pizzas and this really cool pizza cutter and some other stuff. And, Charlie, I've got something special for you. The folks at Palermo's stopped off. There are a couple pizzas for us up in the freezer. Yeah, and you can have one. Absolutely. So, you know, you can have dinner tonight or tomorrow, whatever. So we love Palermo's Pizza, and they are, of course, a regular sponsor of Pop Culture Corner. All right, like the big voice guy says, this is the time we stop talking about, you know, how national secrets got compromised on the Internet and, you know, whether Donald Trump has any chance of winning and all those types of things. We have a little fun going into the weekend. Sometimes we talk about books. Sometimes, matter of fact, I know a number of you want me to do a segment on books, and I promise I'm going to do it in the next couple weeks. Sometimes we talk about sports. Sometimes last week, I think we talked about travel. It's just what's tickled my fancy in a given week that I hope you find interesting. And for today, we revisited something, and we do this in one context or another, maybe once or twice a year. And this is certainly an appropriate day to do this topic. As we talked about yesterday, and as Connie was just mentioning, Jerry Springer, former mayor of Cincinnati, passed away from pancreatic cancer at the age of 79. Jerry Springer, American ringmaster. He created a talk show in the early 1990s. It ran for 27 years, which is amazing in and of itself. And if you ever, and during when it first started, as a matter of fact, in the early 1990s, it was the most popular show on daytime TV. He was going against Oprah Winfrey back when, you know, she had her talk show. And for many years, the Jerry Springer Show, say what this says about our world, Jerry Springer beat Oprah Winfrey. And of course, the Jerry Springer Show, it was, I say this with affection, it was a freak show. I mean, it was the place where, you know, you'd go on, you know, you'd go on the Jerry Springer Show, and the topic would be, you'd find out that your wife of 10 years turns out to be your long lost sister. It was that kind of thing, you know, and then you'd have the fights that would break out. I mean, it was really the lowest common denominator. And Jerry Springer said, look, I understand what this is. This is just entertainment. Don't yell at me. I mean, I'm just the guy that's putting this stuff out there. And if you want to talk about the end of, you know, American culture as we know it, it's not my fault. you know, you guys are watching it. It's what America wants. And he was incredibly, incredibly successful for the longest period of time in an era where, you know, before that you had Phil Donahue and you had the, okay, we're going to have these nice, quiet conversations. I mean, Jerry Springer, it was strippers and cousins who married each other and, you know, family tree is a wreath. It was incredibly, incredibly popular. And here's the bottom line. A lot of people wouldn't admit to watching Jerry Springer, but they watched Jerry Springer. Which brings me to our pop culture corner topic for today. And I admit I am guilty of this, not necessarily watching Jerry Springer because I wasn't around during daytime TV a lot, but I watch a lot of television. I love TV. And some of the stuff I watch, kind of highbrow, I like to watch documentaries and things like that. But I like to watch some of the other stuff as well. So for our topic today, in recognition and in honor of the passing of Jerry Springer, my question is, it's guilty pleasures. All right, that show that you're kind of embarrassed to admit you watch, that show that you have it on and your spouse comes into the room and just says, "What are you watching, Jeff?" And then you just kind of like, "Well, you know, I'm watching so-and-so." You're a really smart guy. Why in the world are you watching fill in the blank? And the only answer is, I just like it. It's escapist, whatever it is. Guilty pleasure. It can be a reality series. It can be a TV show. I mean, I think South Park, for example, is a guilty pleasure as well. You know, and it's a little bit of South Park goes a long way with me, but I admit every once in a while I love that. 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. In recognition and in honor of the passing of Jerry Springer, your guilty pleasure on television, that show that you love watching, but you're not necessarily fond of admitting it. 855-616-1620. And this is your chance to do it on the largest stick in the state. Back with your calls and texts in just a moment.
It's pop culture time. Now back to take your calls. Here's Jeff Wagner.
Yep, Jerry. 855-616-1620. Okay, guilty pleasures. TV shows you're embarrassed to admit you watch. Brian in Sheboygan. Brian, you're first. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
My show is Bar Rescue on
Paramount with John Taffer. Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. Just something about it. You know, he goes in there and he just, you know, rips people a new one. And
yeah.
I don't know. It's just a good show. And
I like Bar Rescue too. What's amazing to me too is so these guys have these failing bars and stuff, and he comes in and he yells at them, and then they always get offended. It's like, okay, haven't you ever watched the show? Don't you understand what's going to happen? And yeah, no, thanks for calling. It is interesting, and then you kind of check and. The success rate on these things isn't great, whether it's Restaurant Impossible, which is another one of my guilty pleasures, or Bar Rescue, because a lot of times the fact that they come in and the bars are so far in the hole, or the restaurants are so far in the hole, that they're never realistically going to dig themselves out of it. But it's kind of interesting to watch this, and you go, boy, how did these people let themselves get into this situation? Let's talk to Dan in New Berlin. Dan, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Dan.
I was wondering, do you remember the show Gong, the Gong Show?
Chucky. Absolutely. Chuck Barris, the Gong Show. That was on, gosh, that's back when I was in college. It goes back that far. I do remember it.
Well, I'm 70 years old, so I remember it pretty well. But that used to be hilarious.
Yep.
They'd have the unknown comic,
right.
Gene, the dance machine, and they had these terrible acts
yep.
that were just terrible.
Yep, exactly.
But people thought they had talent.
They did. No, thanks, Nicole. I'm a big fan of that. You had, and then there was Artie Johnson, who made his career. He was one of the judges a lot of times. Jamie Farr, the guy that played Klinger. J.P. Morgan, who was renowned for exposing herself on network TV. No, that was, I remember the old Gong Show. I loved it. One of my real guilty pleasures for movies is it's almost impossible to find, but they made a movie of that. There's the Gong Show movie floating around, and it's, like I say, it's almost impossible to find, but I kind of liked that one as well. Okay. Don in Illinois. Don, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Don.
My guilty pleasure is Hogan's Heroes, and it's actually one my wife does walk into the room and look at me and go, "What are you watching?"
Yeah, I mean,
I've always liked the kind of the war strategy element, but the slapstick comedy that's combined with it.
Well, who would have thought that you would have ever had a sitcom that would run for 5 years set in a Nazi POW camp? You know, it's just, I mean, it's kind of like, who came up with this concept to make it work? No, it's kind of like, and I've, you know, Bob Crane, who was the guy that played Hogan on the show, you know, he kind of life didn't end up working out very well for him. He was murdered in Arizona at some point in time. But, you know, so I've watched some of the stuff on that. But it was like, okay, who's going to take a chance on this? Some of the real interesting stuff, like the guy that played Sergeant Schultz on Hogan's Heroes, John Banner, he himself was an Austrian Jew who fled right when Hitler annexed Austria, fled the country, came to the United States, and actually served in the United States military. But the guy that plays Sergeant Schultz, the Nazi POW, you know, guard, is, you know, was an Austrian Jew who fought for the United States in World War II. You know, go figure. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to, John in Milwaukee. John, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I am well, thank you. Okay. Just between you and me, your guilty pleasure, TV show you're embarrassed to admit you like.
Naked and Afraid.
Our text line explodes. I would say 50% of the texts are people saying Naked and Afraid. I got to tell you, I've never watched it. It's on Discovery, right? And I've seen the promos for it, and I've just never watched it. But the premise is, you take two people who are naked and you dump them like on some desert island or something like that?
Yeah, a real harsh environment with no food and no water and a couple of tools, and they have to tough it out. It's really interesting, but everybody thinks that it's got some sort of sexual innuendo, which it really doesn't.
Well, no, because I would imagine that I imagine there's all sorts of other things on people's minds. But it's been running for several years now, right? I mean, there is a huge following for this. Yeah, no, thanks. I have to confess, I've seen the promos because I'm a big fan of the Discovery Channel. It's on Discovery, I think. And I mean, look, I love Pawn Stars on the History Channel. My wife will say, okay, why are we watching this? Mine is, I love Gold Rush. I've said that before. You know, it's on Friday nights, and it's all these people in Alaska who are, you know, trying to be gold miners, and some of them are successful, but a lot of them are, you just want to say, just get a job, for God's sake. Get a job, and you'll make a lot more money, but everybody thinks that they're going to strike it rich. And the other one, that the sister show to Gold Rush is even worse. It's Bering Sea Gold. You got a bunch of these people who are going out in these, like, small boats and diving onto the Bering Sea and trying to vacuum up gold. I mean, it's, and I guess I watch it and I think, yeah, no matter what crappy thing might have happened to me, and by the way, I have a great job, I love my life, but you know, if you have a bad day, it doesn't matter. You watch this and you're going to feel better about yourself. I guarantee it. Let's talk to Dick in Sheboygan Falls. Dick, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Dick.
My thing would be reruns of Judge Judy.
Okay. All right. Tell me why.
Oh, my God. I must have saw three or four times. And then I watch him downstairs, and my wife comes down, and she's rolling her eyes. And, oh, he's not bad again.
Yeah. Well, I remember I got started back in the day. Remember before there was Judge Judy, there was the People's Court with Judge Wapner. Remember,
right.
Did you ever watch that one?
That. Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I got into that, and then maybe after I got my law license or something, I stopped that. But that's it. Dick, obviously you have touched a nerve with my producer, Charlie, because you, sir, are the winner of our Palermo's Pizza prize package for the day. So a couple coupons for some frozen pizzas and this cool pizza cutter, and thank you so much for listening. And Judge Judy, that would be a good one. Let me see. I'm trying to – a number of people Hoarders. Oh, yeah. Hoarders would be a guilty pleasure. Jeff, I don't admit I watched Trailer Park Boys on Netflix. I realize it's stupid, but it is funny to me. Let's see. Mine, it's going to, guilty, Little House on the Prairies, 58 years old. It brings me back to a time when we watched with my sister and my mother. Number of people, Moonshiners. I've watched that a couple times, and I can't get past the fact that, okay, there's a TV crew. These guys are supposedly making illegal moonshine, you know, in the hills of wherever. They're out there with a TV crew. Don't you think that the cops would figure this out? Beavis and Butthead, a lot of people like that. Judge Judy, we were getting that as well. But Naked and Afraid. Naked and Afraid, I would say, is getting about half of the nominations for, you know, guilty pleasure TV. But see, that's the fun thing. It's, I think if there wasn't stuff like Jerry Springer, you wouldn't have the Naked and Afraids of the world. And I understand it's different. And by the way, for those of you who are fans of reality TV, it sounds like on Monday, the Hollywood writers are going to be going on strike. There's going to be a writer strike unless there's some like last minute settlement. And that means that a lot of these TV shows that are scripted, they're going to shut down. It's going to start with like the late night things because the writers are going to walk off. But the reality TV shows are different. It's like a different union and stuff. So if you like reality TV shows, I think if the strike happens, that's what it's going to be. The other one, John McCure shares this with me, and he'll be in just a minute. The other guilty pleasure, we used to love Full Throttle Saloon. That's not on the air, but Full Throttle Saloon was at the bike day in Sturgis, the bike week. It was what went on at the Full Throttle Saloon there. It was kind of like Gold Rush on steroids. Anyways, that's Pop Culture Corner for this week. We do it again next week. Thanks for all the texts. Thanks for all the calls.
Thanks for participating in this week's Pop Culture Corner. Stay tuned next week for another pop culture topic.